Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He's a former senior advisor to the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And yesterday, you hosted a conference in New York, Diplomatic History, the Turkish-Armenian Protocols. Today, of course, is the Armenian Genocide Commemoration Day. And yesterday, in conjunction or in concurrent with your forum that you held, David Phillips, of course, the president was at the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., where he talked about the creation of the Atrocities Prevention Board. So obviously, the issue of genocide is very much in the moment, but we don't know much about the Turkish-Armenian protocols. I think all of our listeners probably are surprised to think that there's such a thing even in the works.
On October 10th of 2009, Turkey and Armenia signed agreements to normalize their relations and establish diplomatic relations. This was the product of discrete talks that the Swiss government facilitated over several years, and a decade worth of work by Turks and Armenians on rapprochement. Signing of the protocols was a historic breakthrough. Unfortunately, Turkey never submitted the protocols for ratification to its parliament, and as a result, Armenia suspended its signature on the protocols. As Secretary of State Hillary Clinton stated, the ball is in Turkey's court. So we're back to square one.
So Armenia was prepared to sign it. Is that an assumption?
Armenia made very clear that it would sign the protocols within 24 hours of Turkey doing so. There were a series of delays. It was pretty clear from even the signing ceremony that both sides were getting cold feet. Turkey especially tried to walk back its commitments.
So what is it in these protocols that would at least move these two countries away from confrontation and denial over these decades towards some kind of rapprochement? What is it that Turkey is walking away from?
Significantly, the protocols would have opened the Turkey-Armenia border for normal travel and trade. Right now, the border has been closed since 1993. So it's impossible for Turks and Armenians to easily get together and trade their stories, share their experiences. The event signing the protocols occurs on a specific date, but the process of reconciliation is ongoing, and unless Turks and Armenians are talking to one another, there's very little opportunity to move forward.
So what is the explanation then for this atavism? What is it that Turkey doesn't want to agree to, even though apparently initially they have agreed to something?
The procedural breakthrough was delinking normalization of relations between Turkey and Armenia with a resolution of the conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijan and Armenians fought a bloody war in 1992 and 1993. And as a result of that, the ethnic Armenian enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh fell under Armenian control. Turkey imposed an embargo on Armenia to punish it for the occupied territories. And ever since then, Armenia has been blockaded to its west by Turkey and to its east by Azerbaijan. The protocols were going to delink those two issues. As soon as Azerbaijan objected, Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey immediately went running to Baku and promised that he would never move forward with Armenia unless the so-called occupied territories were released. So the delinkage was undermined, both by Erdogan and Ilham Aliyev, Azerbaijan's president.
So there's the problem, right? That Azerbaijan, now, does that mean that all the work that you and others have done here, the State Department, the Swiss, to bring Turkey and Armenia together, does that mean you have to go back to the table and bring Azerbaijan into the mix?
No, I don't think so. Linking it to Azerbaijan just adds another layer of problem. If we're going to move forward, Turkey needs to fulfill its commitments. Prime Minister Erdogan has a huge electoral mandate. In the spirit of humanitarian action, which is at the core of Islam, he should just submit the protocols to his parliament for ratification. If he's not prepared to do that through an executive order, he can simply have the border open for normal travel and trade and establish diplomatic relations. Turkey is a stronger power. The ball is in Turkey's court. It's incumbent upon Turkey to make the next move.
Again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He's a former senior advisor to the United States Department of State. And on April the 24th, which marks Armenian Genocide Commemoration Day, we're talking about the diplomatic history, the Turkey-Armenian protocols that most people are not aware of, that Turkey and Armenia, in fact, have had discussions about rapprochement starting in 2009, and Turkey has moved away from the table. Of course, still in Turkey today, there are such laws as Article 301 of the Turkish Penal Code that makes it a crime to insult Turkishness, and apparently talking about the Armenian genocide is such an insult.
The broader context for this is the crackdown on freedom of expression in Turkey and increasingly anti-democratic trends of the Justice and Development Party, which is led by Prime Minister Erdogan. I think at this stage he needs to focus not on short-term political gains, but on his legacy. And a good way to do that and to realize the vision of zero problems with neighbors, which is their stated foreign policy, is to address the Armenian question, move forward with the protocols. There are enough problems in that region.
Well, there's also the issue of, as you brought up, David Phillips, of crackdowns at home. I mean, Penn International have released data saying that Turkey has the world's highest imprisonment rate for journalists. By the end of 2011, according to Penn International, there were 30 writers in prison in Turkey and 70 on trial.
I think the number is even larger than that. And in addition, any opponent of the government has been rounded up and accused of conspiring with the military and secularists to undermine Erdogan's administration. I think 10% of current and former military leaders are now in jail waiting trial. That's hardly the kind of democratic environment that you want for a NATO member and a pro-Western ally.
Well, but that's always been the concern on the part of critics of Turkey in the West, and it's also been an issue, of course, in holding and preventing Turkey's entry into the European Union is the extent to which the Islamists want to create an Islamic State. And there have been all kinds of scholars and specialists and pundits have assured us that Erdogan's party is progressive and a different form of Islam, and not a neo-theocratic party, if you will. But what we're talking about now certainly gives one pause.
The jury is still out on Erdogan's Islamist tendencies. He talks a good game about secular governance, but he's been insidiously inserting Islamists into positions of power and undermining through the judiciary the control that secularists have had over Turkey since Atatürk rose in that country.
Well, but it's worth noting that the core of secularism in Turkey has been the military, and they have been oppressive over the years and had endless numbers of coups, and finally they have been sort of put back in the barracks, if you will. But the fact that Erdogan is, what percentage of military officers do you say he's arrested?
10%.
10%. Are the military still trying to interfere in domestic affairs?
Yes, they are. Whether or not they're planning to overthrow the government is a matter of speculation by the government itself. But you put your finger on a very important point, Ian. Turkey has been repressed for decades by right-wing extremist military figures and ultra-nationalists who are carrying the secular banner. Now they're being afflicted by an Islamist-led government, which is cracking down on freedom of expression. There is no centrist or social democratic party in Turkey, which is progressive and westward-leaning. That's the real conundrum for U.S. policymakers. How does it get along with Turkey, which plays an indispensable role geopolitically, given these increasingly anti-democratic tendencies?
Well, Turkey's clearly emerged quite recently as an important and growing power in the Middle East, and in many ways a pivotal power. Its relations with Israel, which were always good, have completely reversed themselves. Turkey was instrumental in hosting the recent talks between the G5 plus one and Iran over Iran's nuclear issues. And it's also, as I mentioned earlier, for the longest time been trying to get entry into the European Union. And it's faced, frankly, some opposition from countries like France that appear to be based more in xenophobia and racism than in any real objections that one could acknowledge. So what is the U.S. policy now towards this important emerging power? Are we just trying to get along with them? And how could you create that middle space? Does that middle space exist?
It's important that Washington sees Turkey as it is, not as it used to be or as we wish it were. When U.S. and Turkey's interests overlap, there's considerable room for the two countries to work together, as we have in Libya and are doing now presently in Syria. What Erdogan has shown is that he's not going to act at the behest of the United States. He will act in concert with Washington when it serves Turkey's interests. And there are still plenty of times when the U.S. and Turkish interests overlap. We just have to find instances where we can work together and then exploit those opportunities. But Turkey as a reliable ally is increasingly being called into question.
But what about the middle space there in Turkey that you referred to, David Phillips? Again, David Phillips, director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He's a former senior advisor to the United States Department of State. You said you've got the new Islamist party that may be not quite as moderate as is the moderate face that it's gone to great pains to project to the world. And you've got the kind of recalcitrant right-wing military that have been put back in their barracks but are restive. Give us a sense of where the middle space is. My understanding is that Turkey is a fairly modern country with a growing middle class, and given the secular traditions imposed since Ataturk, you would think that there's quite a constituency in the middle.
That's a mistaken impression. You know, the progressives in Turkey are increasingly few and far between. And there's another problem with Turkey's domestic politics that deserves mention, which is the Kurdish question. Erdogan launched a big initiative called the Democracy Opening, where he promised through democratization and development to address the core grievances of Turkey's 20 million Kurds. And other than opening a Kurdish language television station with a statement in Kurdish, Turkey has done nothing to try to liberalize conditions for the Kurds. That's why its continued struggle with the PKK is ongoing, and why Kurds in the region are increasingly radicalized. So this Kurdish question remains unresolved and is potentially very destabilizing in Turkey as the country tries to sort out the Arab Spring, and given the Kurdish population in Syria, how it's going to manage the situation there.
But what about the middle space there in Turkey that you referred to, David Phillips? Again, David Phillips, director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He's a former senior advisor to the United States Department of State. You said you've got the new Islamist party that may be not quite as moderate as is the moderate face that it's gone to great pains to project to the world. And you've got the kind of recalcitrant right-wing military that have been put back in their barracks but are restive. Give us a sense of where the middle space is. My understanding is that Turkey is a fairly modern country with a growing middle class, and And given the secular traditions imposed since Ataturk, you would think that there's quite a constituency in the middle.
That's a mistaken impression. You know, the progressives in Turkey are increasingly few and far between. And there's another problem with Turkey's domestic politics that deserves mention, which is the Kurdish question. Erdogan launched a big initiative called the Democracy Opening, where he promised through democratization and development to address the core grievances of Turkey's 20 million Kurds. And other than opening a Kurdish language television station with a statement in Kurdish, Turkey has done nothing to try to liberalize conditions for the Kurds. That's why its continued struggle with the PKK is ongoing, and why Kurds in the region are increasingly radicalized. So this Kurdish question remains unresolved and is potentially very destabilizing in Turkey as the country tries to sort out the Arab Spring, and given the Kurdish population in Syria, how it's going to manage the situation there.
Well, the understanding, I think it's pretty widespread, isn't it, David Phillips, that the Turks are playing a very positive role in Syria. They were quite close to the Assad regime. They've turned on them. They're offering havens. And given the brutality that's going on in Syria and the number of refugees escaping into Turkey, it would seem that at some point soon, Turkey will reach a critical mass. If it gets up to 100,000 refugees, I think it's going to get more aggressive in its response to Syria. What's your thoughts?
Turkey has hosted the Syrian National Council. The Liberation Army also has bases in Turkey. There are now about 15,000 to 20,000 Syrian refugees on Turkish soil. But I think it's important to be clear about Turkey's motivation. The Kurds in Syria represent about 10% of the population, and they haven't yet identified with either the opposition or with Assad. They're sitting on the fence to see which way it goes. Meanwhile, Assad is giving them citizenship and other rights. The PKK was historically based in Syria. Now that you have an autonomous Kurdish region in Syria with links to Iraqi Kurdistan and a resurgent PAJOK, which is the Kurdish group in Iran, you have an axis of Kurdish communities connecting with the PKK and potentially destabilizing Turkey through military activity. So Turkey's primary motivation here is to preempt this axis of Kurdish interests coalescing. I'm not so sure that Ankara is motivated by human rights concerns for Syrians.
Well, let's just in closing then, David Phillips, turn back to today's commemoration, if you will, of the Armenian Genocide Commemoration Day. And obviously, we're talking about moving from commemoration to conversation, an attempt that was made in terms of the Turkey-Armenian protocols, which have yet to succeed, and also to confront denial, which seems to be fairly rife and entrenched, particularly on the Turkish side. Going back, though, to the actual Armenian genocide itself in 1915, Armenians claimed up to 1.5 million people were killed during World War II as the Ottoman Empire collapsed. Turkey argues that 300,000 to 500,000 Armenians and at least as many Turks died in the civil strife when Armenia rose up against the Ottoman rulers and sided with the invading Russian army. So whose narrative is correct?
They actually are both correct. As the Ottoman Empire disintegrated, it shrunk to about a third of its size. Many hundreds of thousands of Turks, mostly in the Balkan Wars, perished or were driven from their homelands in what is now southeastern Europe. But we should not allow moral equivalency. While acknowledging the suffering of Turks during that period, it can't be equated to the deportation orders from Talat Pasha and other Ottoman rulers that directly led to the death of up to 1.5 million Armenians.
One of the ironies, I understand, David Phillips, is that the people who actually did the killing as the Armenians escaped south across the deserts into Syria were the Kurds.
That's true to some extent. That's a Turkish version of history. I'm not sure that's really been fully documented. What's important here is to note that the crime of genocide has four elements. One or more persons were killed. They belong to a specific ethnic, racial, or religious group. There was a pattern to their killing, and the person who was doing the killing had the intent for the victim to die. Clearly, when the Ottoman rulers issued the deportation orders, not only in eastern Anatolia, but for Armenians throughout the Ottoman Empire, they knew that there was going to be mass suffering and many deaths. So those events meet the definition of genocide. It's important that Turks and Armenians have a dialogue about what happened. The only way that you can move forward into the future is by addressing the past openly and honestly through a discourse. Turks and Armenians are doing that. Unfortunately, the Turkish government has withdrawn from the conversation. It should come back to the table.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. He's a former senior advisor to the United States Department of State, and yesterday in New York, he hosted a seminar, Diplomatic History, the Turkish-Armenian Protocols. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Scott Horton about the R2P, the responsibility to protect.